Good evening. This is Mae Russell. This is World Watchers program number 689, February the 18th, 1985. Every listener-sponsored station has their marathon, and at the time during the winter when our tower was down, I asked people who live out of the area if they would help in some way to show their appreciation to Kazoo for this kind of broadcasting. And my subscribers to the tapes were wonderful and did help. So if I request funds next week and we have the marathon going, those of you who sent in, this didn't apply to you. I appreciate what you did. It's for those that have listened and have not sent in funds, and many directly in our listening audience couldn't know why the towers were down, although they might have figured it out. So the marathon will be for them, and next week we'll get into that. I don't know how many of you read Doonesbury Cartoon by Gary Trudeau. I think he's one of the few geniuses in this country. There may be a lot of them around, but I don't know about them. They're totally brilliant, and he's been doing a series on the medical schools down in the Caribbean, in Haiti, and such as the Grenada Hospital that was so controversial. The students were the excuse for the invasion of the island, you remember, in the fall of 83. He has a person, a head of the faculty, interviewing a new member of the faculty, or one that he doesn't know very well, and on the telephone a person is saying he's trying to make some tenure decisions, and frankly he doesn't know all the doctors as well as he should. That's the man who's the head of the medical school. So the next shot shows three people on the edge of the water in the Caribbean, and the director of the school, of the university, is saying, honey tells me you used to work for the Gestapo. And the person he's interviewing is a well on in years with a man with a monocle, and he looks just like Mr. Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger's mentor. And he says, well, yes. And then his wife says, now, dear, none of your old war stories. They're holding their croquet mallet. And let's not get into the past. And that's about it. That was a pretty apropos and very pertinent cartoon with a few words to say so much. Mr. Conrad, who does cartoons for the LA Times, is another genius. And as I say, there aren't too many of them around. The University of California students have put a proposal. They want to order their suicide pills in case of a nuclear holocaust. And this came up in the San Jose Mercury and the local papers. And the chancellor of the university says, no way that you can vote for your suicide pills, but they're not going to administer them. And the plea for suicide pills was compared to Jonestown. I have a large listening audience to this program at the University of Santa Cruz, and I'd like to suggest, if any of you are thinking of doing a thing like that, why don't you divert your time to trying to live and change things to make them better instead of trying to have a lot of fun until the bomb falls and then getting wiped out? Give your life some meaning. If you want to call me, I'm listed in the phone book. You can come down and copy articles and list books, index books for me, index the sheets that I have that go with the broadcast. I can use your help, and you can volunteer and call various congressmen for me. I don't have time to do all of that and the research, and I'll put you to work and see if we can't use our lives to make a dent into some of the things that are happening. At least if you're going to die, die knowing that you've done something for whatever it is, try to make the earth a little better instead of a cop-out. So I have an invitation for students from UC Santa Cruz who listen to this broadcast. If you want to participate in trying to change history a little bit, I don't promise it'll happen, but some things have happened in my lifetime, and I've been satisfied with those and felt that there is some meaning in doing this kind of research. Now, the past few months since November, I've been delving heavily into the news and the history of the situations that we're in today, going back to 1943 when the OSS was working with the Gestapo, when our intelligence systems and the British intelligence under William Stevenson were working with the top Nazis such as SS Karl Wolf and Reinhard Gehlen, and Clay Shaw was bringing in Mr. Walter Dornberger and Wernher von Braun and the network of Nazis under the guise of rocket scientists. They were working with people later involved and arrested for having a role in the murder of John Kennedy. And I've been trying to follow the historic connections because in the last few years, it's become more and more interesting, the chronological order of the meeting of people and then what follows afterwards. And I'm going to take a break for the next 2 or 3 weeks, possibly, and just update the news because I've had so many controversial items and things of interest for the past years on the air, going on the 14th year, that I want to update certain things that are in the news now and not let them slip by. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to jump from one section of the news to the other for the next 3 weeks and then get back to another historical section that I think will be of extreme interest to you. That area will be the combination of the Soldier of Fortune magazines and the Survivalist magazines and the World Anti-Communist League with its Nazi origins and its current Nazi connections and Western goals of the Los Angeles Police Department and the American Security Council. I'll be doing 3 or 4 weeks on combining those four as representing the identical to Hitler's SS, the secret Gestapo group. We're grooming our own private armies and the death squads that have been in existence overtly and recognizable since 1963, when H.L. Hunt wanted to start his own American assassination group to kill people in the United States. And I've saved thousands of articles of people that I believe have been victims of these murder plots that have not yet been identified as having disappeared or being openly murdered and passed off as robberies or car accidents or suicide that were part of a pattern of murder, and I've kept those for many years. Now to the local news, and as many as we can get to, not local, getting the current news as against going back to the historical section. The New York Daily News had a item, February 22nd, 1985, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, former bodyguard to Pope John Paul II, left the Vatican. He's returned now. He just returned from a visit at Bob Hope's mansion, where he prayed in the private chapel of Dolores Hope. He was accompanied by Vatican envoy to the United States, Pio Lagi, L-A-G-I. Now, the article, just a brief social article, fails to say that Mr. Marcinkus was not only the bodyguard of the Pope. He's now relegated to being the former bodyguard. He was formerly in charge of the Vatican Bank, where $2.4 billion was missing down in the Bahamas with dummy fronts, not recognizable sources of delivering the money, and the many scandals that broke with the Masonic Lodge story and Roberta Calvi and the Banco Ambrosiano. And Marcinkus was under investigation by the New York Crime Task Force 10 years before John Paul II was Pope. He worked with Cardinal Montini, who became Pope Paul VI, and the Vatican Mafia, and he's been involved with every scandal that the Vatican can have, from murder to stock swindles to death squads to narcotics traffic to supplying atomic weapons for the Middle East, right? You know, gun smuggling, narcotics, and everything else. Marcinkus, for all purposes, has been a prisoner inside the Vatican. He obviously got protection and permission to leave because he was here. The interesting thing was that he was at Bob Hope's home. Bob Hope is a well-known, staunch conservative, a friend of Ronald Reagan's. Down in Palm Springs, there are a lot of elements. There's Gerald Ford, the former president. There is a stronghold of the mafia that sit in the sun. It's sort of the dry version of Monte Carlo. But Bob Hope has stayed in arm's distance from these people, other than voting and parting with them. He hasn't entertained anyone like Paul Marcinkus that I know of. Maybe he has, but it's strange to plunk him right in the desert into Bob Hope's lap at this time. So I would venture that something very, very important is going to happen or is happening, and I would make an educated guess it has to do with Joseph Mengele, Klaus Barbie, and John DeLorean. And I'll do more of that in a few minutes. John DeLorean then going to NBC and the cocaine connections in Hollywood, and then it travels and circumvents all the higher areas that I have linked together on charts before. There has to be some very important reason for his flying there and back. Also, in the Washington Post 2 months ago, December 4th, there was a picture of God's banker Michael Sindona, smiling from a defendant's cage. He's behind bars in Italy. He was in United States jail, serving time for causing the collapse of $45 million in the Franklin National Bank. That's God's banker, the envoy to invest the money of the Pope and the Vatican, who got tangled in all kinds of financial collapses in Italy. The United States hardly needed him to do us a favor, and he's wanted for hiring a man to kill an investigator in his case and also for the collapsing of banks in Italy. He's over there behind bars, and Marcinkus just flew here quickly. The book on Citizen News is causing a lot of talk show, conversation, the blah blahs, the interview with Michael Drosnin. As I've said before, any book that becomes a bestseller immediately based on stolen papers written by a man who nobody saw from 1966 to 1970 has to be questioned, and these documents are doing very well, and Mr. Drosnin is a phenomenon. We could really study him because he has captured the imagination of people with use, but is that really use? There's no proof that it is use and not a fingerprint, but he's got himself a bestseller. Well, the author had an interview, not a book review, in the Los Angeles Herald, February 15th. And this is a little bit about the author, Michael Drosnin. Author's communion with Citizen News. During the 7 years he struggled to write his book, Michael Drosnin recalls times when he would hold Howard Hughes' memos in his hands and try to commune with a dead billionaire. "I like Howard Hughes," Drosnin said. "It's a good thing I did, or I wouldn't have been able to get through this." He's ultimately an appealing figure. That tells you about Drosnin, because there isn't anything appealing about Howard Hughes. He was a genius. He was a mechanic. He could invent and put together airplanes that go fast and fly fast and make the proper people put together missiles and weapons of war. There is nothing appealing about him as a person. He goes on, he was so innocent of his own evil. He was so self-evolved, he only saw his own needs. That has to be the biggest lie in the world. If he saw his own needs, he'd be living in a castle like Hugh Hefner and have all the broads around. He used to be a ladies' man and liked women. So this is really ridiculous that his needs are met. He never saw what he was doing to others. How does Drosnin know that from those memos? I have the book here, but where do you draw the conclusion that he doesn't know what he's doing to others? He's ready to strike them dead, buy them off, take from the entire Democratic Party, its whole network, whoever was running the Hughes organization, and pay them lock, stock, and barrel to be his, literally ending the two-party system. That's what ended when John Kennedy was murdered, and those links go to the right to this organization, as well as Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. He was an anti-villain. That's Drosnin's opinion, now that he's making $1 million off of it. And he was so vulnerable. I don't think he ever had a moment of joy. Vulnerable, yes, but who analyzes joy? He had joy until he was kidnapped. He had joy until 1957 when Jack Eggers and Bobby Hall and this gang put him in that bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel and gave him Hershey bars and Perrier water till he was constipated day and night and watched these horror movies. I have a list of the films he saw and murder mysteries day after day after day running. Who has a moment of joy when you're locked in a door and no one can call you, no one can get through the door? How can he define joy? He says, "There will forever be a stream of interest in Howard Hughes," says Drosnin. "He was the perfect vehicle for everyone's fantasies." He was the perfect vehicle for Drosnin's fantasies, and it'll be for your fantasies, too. If you buy that book, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, play with it if you want. It's garbage. It's like the Warren Report. It's perfect for your fantasies of who Oswald is. It says he was the one man who could do anything he wanted to. How does Drosnin know that? How does he know once he was in that bungalow he could get out? How does he know that he didn't want to get out? In fact, the person writing the memos wanted to get out and go to the Watergate committee or see any human being. It was even written there, this poor Vance Cooper filled with these needles and medications, the living dead, similar to Auschwitz or Dachau. Why do they celebrate the Holocaust there? Look at that body. He didn't do anything he wanted to. We don't know if he did anything at all after 1957 that he wanted to. And after he left that Boston hospital in 1966 with that brain surgery, could he do anything he wanted to? I'm dwelling at this at length because these are the myths you have to break. These are the lies of our country, and the liars are paid well. He says the irony was that what he did with his freedom was imprison himself. He didn't have the freedom to say, I want to be in this room. If he wanted to get out, they would never let him out. If somebody wanted to see him, they couldn't see him. It wasn't his choice. I remember Terry Moore saying, you know, she tried to make contact when he was at the bungalow. She couldn't get through. No one could get through. The idea that he imprisoned himself is like saying that those people that were put in the ovens burned themselves. Well, actually, they did. If they didn't vote against Hitler and they didn't oppose fascism and they didn't speak up at the time of the Spanish Civil War, they actually did choose their own destiny. Maybe we could argue that for hours, but he didn't imprison himself. And this article goes on, like most things use touch, this volume has engendered controversy. Of course it has. Its central thesis is that Hughes tried to buy the United States government and nearly succeeded. Now, that's the part that really galled me, besides him saying that he's likable and that, you know, how much he loved him and he's so appealing and he wouldn't do anything to hurt others. He's the anti-villain. How does Mr. Drozdin know he nearly succeeded? I could prove to you, lock, stock, and barrel, that the people who kidnapped Howard Hughes succeeded with everything they wanted. It talks about illicit payoffs that he tried to make to dead politicians like Johnson and Hubert Humphrey. How do we know he tried? I still believe he could do it. It says, as well as living ones, like Senator Paul Laxalt and Richard Nixon. Well, Laxalt runs the GOP. He runs the whole entire Republican Party. Ronald Reagan can't run unless there's funds. He carries the funds. And there's a picture when Edwin Meese was confirmed. Who was celebrating? His face is in the newspaper. This past Sunday, Senator Paul Laxalt with Strom Thurmond and Robert Dole celebrating after Meese's confirmation. They're all happy. There's Paul Laxalt. He got Edwin Meese, the man who wouldn't send Edgar Eugene Bradley to Clay Shaw, who worked with the Minutemen, who worked with Reverend Gale, and in California, Reagan and Meese and the California Parafascist State we talk about. There is Laxalt in all his glory. He got the attorney general he wanted, and the attorney general decides who's prosecuted and who gets off, and that's the most important job in the country, and he's running the party that Howard Hughes wanted in power. This report goes on, he claimed that Hughes triggered the Watergate break-in and Nixon's downfall is hotly debated. We won't go into that part right now. And finally, this article says, the memos are lucid and well-crafted. You bet they're well-crafted, and you bet they're more lucid than a man who's locked into there with that kind of a diet. It says it outlined the billionaire's goals. One, to manipulate the White House and perhaps choose the next president of the United States. How do you know that wasn't done? Even when Hughes was alive in the 50s, by 57, it was decided that Ronald Reagan, who was caravanning with General Electric, would have the role that he has today. You just had to murder a few people and get them out of the way that are linked directly to Howard Hughes and Ronald Reagan, Edwin Meese, and you're home free. After all, Reagan was governor and Meese was the legal advisor when Robert Kennedy was killed at the Ambassador Hotel, and there's more links than that to these people. It says he wants to choose the next president of the United States. He wanted to pay no taxes. Who got him off the taxes? Larry O'Brien of the Democratic Party, who he brought in as soon as Robert Kennedy was killed. He wrote the tax laws for the Medical Institute that saved Hughes millions and millions of dollars that would have gone into our treasury. Look how the debt has escalated. But these people don't pay taxes. Who did they use? The Democratic lawyer on the payroll of Howard Hughes. And he wanted to buy Las Vegas, perhaps the state of Nevada. What makes you think he didn't buy the state of Nevada? There are three elements that buy Nevada. One is the Mormons, who are heavily behind Ronald Reagan, and I'll go into that in a minute. The other is the mafia and the skimming table and the money, the gambling syndicate, which, and also Paul Laxalt is a Mormon, and he's part of the mafia group that let them buy up those huge tables so the skimming money would be theirs, and also the military. Nevada is a Mormon state, a mafia state, and a military, the three M's, and I don't mean the Scotch tape M's. The military bases, Great Britain wants to test atomic bombs under the ground, they come to Nevada to put their big bombs under their huge budget and huge bombs. And now they want to close off a good hunk of Nevada for other space experiments and for training. There's a large controversy going on that. He got the state of Nevada, and he got Las Vegas. What more? The people behind you that are running the organization, not that skinny old thing that's lying on a bed with needles in it. Drosnin likes him, never saw what he was doing to others. It's a bunch of BS. Just look it through and save articles on what he's saying. As I say, we'll take parts of the book from time to time. Well, Ed Meese was confirmed, and there is Strom Thurmond smiling with Laxalt, celebrating the confirmation in the Senate of Ed Meese. And in a few weeks, as I say, I'm going to talk about the World Anti-Communist League, one of the four factors of the control of our government. One of the people on the World Anti-Communist League is Strom Thurmond, the one smiling and so happy that Meese was confirmed. He's a key figure in the Tonkin Park scandals, and I'll do more of his links to the fascist kingpin, Giorgio Almirante, and Angenter Press, the terrorist group in Italy, the P2, the Masonic Lodge. The Young Americans for Freedom are closely tied to the World Anti-Communist League, and they were the people instrumental with behind the putting in Ronald Reagan and getting rid of John Kennedy. And of course, Reagan was on the board of the Young Americans for Freedom, and you have Strom Thurmond and the politicians tying in that was a branch of the John Birch Society. Thurmond is happy and tied directly to Paul Laxalt. These people have a direct connection to SS commando leader Karl Otto Skorzeny, I talk about so much, and former Luftwaffe pilot Hans Ulrich Rudel. Skorzeny and Rudel go back and up to Buffalo to Mr. Erlinger, and down from Washington State and Oregon and Utah, down into the lap of Reagan and Meese, and the people behind the Hughes kidnapping, drugging, disappearance, and those memos that he's writing about are the meanest people who will bring you to this network of fascism that the United States is getting enveloped in. And as Reagan said when he won this last election, you ain't seen nothing yet. Another review of the book in the San Francisco Chronicle. Before we get to the book, I just want to, from time to time, go over these reviews that are taking place. The Delusions of a Sick Man. This is by Steve Magagnini, Magagnini. And just in the review, he says, in the end, America and the presidency could not be bought by Hughes. The heck it wasn't bought by whoever was behind Hughes. And it says, here we learn that despite million-dollar bribe offers, he was unable to halt testing. Well, owning the White House has nothing to do with nuclear testing at all. Then it says he planned to take over ABC television network but failed. What proof does Drosnin have that there was not a successful takeover of ABC? That is, the attorney for Howard Hughes is the same attorney, well, they have a whole list of them, but the Hughes organization was the same attorney for ABC and transferred on to ABC and then to MGM Studios. The connection of the not only the legal staff, but the organization is very tight. ABC is the most controlled of the three major networks. It's the one with the least dialogue, the least expose. You know, NBC and CBS are right behind them. But if the Hughes organization didn't buy ABC, they sure have an identical twin. And the idea that they failed is totally ridiculous. Of course, there's a lot in the book about Larry O'Brien and his working for the Democrats, running the Democratic Party at the time of Watergate, and that the Hughes people want to know if O'Brien was going to tell the Democrats about his connection to Hughes. Not in your life would he tell. I mean, he's making all that money with the Hughes people and helping them with those tax breaks. as I say, that was the end of the Democratic Party. After John Kennedy was murdered, they already lost, flaked away and lost their allegiance. Even though O'Brien was the titular head of the Democratic Party at the time of Watergate. And then Mr. Frank Mankiewicz, another well-known Democrat, goes on to the company that took over from Howard Hughes. The Mullen Associates was the Howard Hughes organization in Washington, D.C., for overseas representing the Mormon Church, and it was run by Mr. Bennett of the Mormon Church. Mr. Robert Keith Gray is the office, his group called the Powerhouse. His office is the Hughes organization, literally intact, the contacts with William Casey and Senator Paul Laxalt and the Central Intelligence Agency and the Democratic, former Democratic bigwig press manager for this Mankiewicz was for John Kennedy at the press secretary when Kennedy was president. Frank Mankiewicz is now one of the big vice presidents of the Robert Keith Gray Organization. The Gray Organization sent a letter, if you're on their mailing list, and I'll give you the address if you want. They call it the Powerhouse. He sent a letter of three new promotions in his office, and this is a continuation of the Hughes Organization. See, Drozden makes you think he tried all this and he died, and he was pitiful, and he was a little prisoner. Robert Keith Gray has a series of promotions in his company. One is Robert S. Carter, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, who will be vice president of marketing in Robert Keith Gray. Donald Massey, former chief counsel to the Senate Committee on Appropriations. And Carter served as executive assistant to William Casey, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. So he worked for William Casey. He's now part of Robert Gray's organization. Carter worked for the Agency of International Development and the United States Information Agency, which are CIA organizations. He held leadership positions in the last seven Republican national conventions, mixing your intelligence community with your GOP. Then they took on a man named Mr. Massey, experienced in the Appropriation Committee. He was Deputy Sergeant-at-Arms of the Senate, Minority Counsel to the Committee on Rules and Administration, and Assistant Legislative Counsel and Intelligence Analyst for the CIA. They brought in Donald F. Massey to work for them, and he was also with the Central Intelligence Agency, now with Robert Gray. And then they brought in another promotion is Mr. Chauchet, S-C-H-O-C-H-E-T, Barry Chauchet, former counsel of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Chauchet worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and will specialize in international and administrative law. And Senior Vice President Bruce Fine, former General Counsel of Federal Communications, will become head of Telecommunication and Information Corps. They brought in a Mr. Henry Hubbard, who was a former Deputy Chief of Newsweek's Washington Bureau, to be Senior Vice President. So the promotions go on at Robert Keith Gray's office, and that is the very closest proximity to Paul Laxalt and William Casey, going back to the OSS. Casey, the protege of Donovan, and Laxalt, the protege of the Hughes organization, and because of the Watergate scandals and the Mullen office representing Howard Hughes entirely, that's what it was, whoever the Hughes is. Can you imagine the power of the Mullen office and this so-called Hughes that nobody sees, who's disappeared from these various hotels in London, Vancouver, and the Bahamas? And Mr. Drozden is telling you that Hughes is dead and gone in terms of activity, that he's a prisoner, and that all that he has in the world are these memos. These memos exist in a sense that they were written. But as I say, there are no fingerprints on these memos. Nobody has said those are the hands of Howard Hughes. That's why they developed that germ conscious story, because they didn't want anybody to see the fingerprints didn't compare with a real Howard Hughes. So by saying he had to use a Kleenex to touch something, there was a contradiction that he couldn't pick up a piece of paper, but he could live with his urine and live in the bed with all the feces, and they didn't have to change him. One didn't matter because they didn't care how dirty and sick he got, and the other one, they didn't want you to identify who they were making dirty and sick. And this is a point I will have to bring up over and over. If you want to understand America, and before you take your suicide pills, there are two things to dissect. Just as to understand the human body, there are certain things you have to understand. One is the Kennedy assassination and the people involved in it, thinking in terms of a military operation identical to going to war, World War II, or into Vietnam. The Kennedy assassination and the Howard Hughes story are very important. And if you don't understand those, you cannot understand what is happening, why we're putting in the military dictatorships, why we're forming our own private armies, why we have death squads in this country. If you don't delve into the Hughes story and the Kennedy assassination, nothing else that you read will make sense. There are a lot of people, researchers and writers, that get angry at me for stressing those two things, because they will pass those off as not important to minor stories, and nothing is as important as Howard Hughes, what happened to him after 1957, and John Kennedy. I'll take a 1-minute break and then be back with the second half of this broadcast.